From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about the early days of rhythm and blues with bandleader and musician Johnny Otis. His hits include the 1958 record Willie and the Hand Jive. He also discovered singers Jackie Wilson, Etta James, Little Esther, and Hank Ballard. Also today, rock historian Ed Ward listens back to Roy Orbison's early sessions. We talk with actor Jerry Orbach about his role in Woody Allen's new movie, Crimes and Misdemeanors. He plays the brother of the ophthalmologist, the brother with underworld connections. And book critic John Leonard reviews Isera, the latest work from Nobel laureate Wally Soyanka. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. Leftist rebels in San Salvador stormed a luxury hotel today and claimed to hold at least four Americans and a number of other foreign military advisors. The guerrillas have pinned down another 70 foreigners during 10 hours of gunfire. The Salvadoran government says the assault on the Sheraton was a plot to kidnap the OAS Secretary General. Government officials say they pulled Joao Baena Suarez and several others from the hotel hours after the siege began. The Bush administration has called the rebel advance a terrorist act and promised to do what is necessary to protect American lives. Details from NPR's Richard Gonzalez.
The State Department's Margaret Tutwiler called the rebel action terrorism, pure and simple, but she declined to discuss the status of the Americans being held, nor would she say how many Americans are inside the hotel.
The situation in El Salvador is very fluid and dangerous. We will not speculate on the steps that either the El Salvadorian government or the United States government may take.
Earlier, White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater said that no options, including military ones, are being ruled out. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Former presidential press secretary James Brady testified on Capitol Hill today in favor of a bill named in his honor that would impose a 7-day waiting period to buy handguns. Brady was testifying for the first time since he was shot in the head during an attempt on the life of President Reagan in 1981. NPR's Neil Conan reports.
Brady, who's partially paralyzed, spoke from his wheelchair and said Congress was gutless for refusing to take on the gun lobby.
They have closed their eyes to the tragedies like mine. They ignored the statistics. Well, this statistic has decided to break his silence.
The bill named after Jim Brady was narrowly defeated last year in favor of a substitute that called on the Justice Department to institute an instantaneous identification system which would prevent convicted felons from buying guns. This week, Attorney General Thornburg wrote that such a system cannot be started for several years at least. Given that, supporters of the Brady bill say they will resume the fight for a waiting period. Opponents, including the National Rifle Association, said a wait would be an unfair burden on honest citizens and do little to keep guns out of the hands of criminals. This is Neil Conan reporting.
A federal judge in the Iran-Contra case of arms dealer Albert Hakim today first rejected and then accepted Hakim's guilty plea to a single misdemeanor charge as part of a deal requiring him to cooperate with prosecutors. Judge Gerhard Gesell also accepted a guilty plea to a single felony charge of unauthorized use of government funds by Lake Resources Incorporated, a foreign corporation controlled by Hakim that is implicated in the Iran-Contra scandal. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 7 points today to close at 2639.29. This is NPR News. After 5 days of the largest anti-government demonstrations in 20 years, Czechoslovakia's prime minister met with opposition leaders today. The news of the meeting was met with cheers from a crowd of more than 300,000 in Venceslav Square. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Prague.
The first news of the meeting between Ladislav Adamec, the prime minister, and four opposition members came at a rally in Venceslav Square this afternoon. The four are part of Civic Forum, an opposition group that's emerged in the past few days. The information was given by the country's leading dissident, Václav Havel, who said the prime minister had agreed to a dialogue, an investigation of police brutality, and no martial law. Havel spoke from a balcony to the largest crowd to gather in the country for 20 years. They repeated their call for the resignation of the Communist Party chief Miloš Jakeš. He appeared on television tonight and said he wanted an end to tension, but the country would continue its socialist path. In Prague, this is Deborah Amos.
President Bush signed into law today a $286 billion defense appropriations bill that will reduce U.S. military spending in real terms for the fifth year in a row. Bush said the law would meet most of his administration's defense priorities, but he criticized Congress for cutting spending on the Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative. It's the first time that spending for the space-based defense program has been cut since it was launched by then-President Reagan in 1983. The Senate today approved a proposal to salvage some catastrophic medical benefits for older Americans and urged the House to abandon its effort to kill the entire program. Leaders in both houses, trying to wrap up a session of Congress by tonight, vowed not to adjourn for the year without repealing an unpopular surtax that finances the program. Final Senate bill would kill the surtax and repeal extended Medicare benefits for doctor bills and prescriptions. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Johnny Otis, has been a rhythm and blues musician, singer, bandleader, songwriter, producer, and talent scout. He started out leading a big band that had the 1945 hit Harlem Nocturne. Soon after, his band, like most of the big bands, broke up for financial reasons. Otis organized a smaller unit that played a hybrid of swing and blues that became known as rhythm and blues. Otis's Rhythm and Blues Caravan became the first R&B touring roadshow. Through his nightclub, talent shows, and roadshow, Otis discovered such singers as Etta James, Little Esther, Jackie Wilson, Big Mama Thornton, and Hank Ballard. Otis had many R&B hits in the early 50s, and in 1958, his record Willie and the Hand Jive made it to the top 10 of the rock and roll chart. Although Otis is a pioneer of R&B and has played almost exclusively with black performers, he is a white Greek American. During the British invasion of the 60s, there was little interest in rhythm and blues and few bookings for Johnny Otis. But now Johnny Otis is back on the road and in the recording studio. Two new albums are due out soon, and Capitol Records has just reissued sessions from the 1950s. But let's begin with his first hit, the 1945 Harlem Nocturne. There's a great story behind recording this record. Would you tell it?
Well, this goes back to the mid-40s, and it was my first record date with my own band, as I recall. And we did three things. I went to the producer after we had completed the third one. I said, well, Mr. Rene, that's it. Three songs in 4 hours, and we got plenty of time left. He said, no, you've got that wrong. It's four songs in 3 hours. Now get out there and get another song together. So we were the house band at the Club Alabama on Central Avenue here in L.A. at the time. And I remember when we would play this particular song, the chorus girls and the showgirls would come out of the balcony, out of their dressing rooms and dance on the balcony. And they would always ask us to play it. And I thought it must have some charm. The ladies like it that well. So I said, let's play that. And it was a stock arrangement that had been recorded once before by Ray Noble. And an Earl Hagen tune. So, but I slowed it down, and I was a drummer. Then I did, went boom, boom, boom on the tom-toms, and we recorded it. And the songs that we had done previously with Jimmy Rushin, the great Count Basie singer, and some wonderful arrangements, they didn't do it. But Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit.
And when Harlem Nocturne became an instant hit, then you started touring with Louis Jordan and with the Ink Spots. And they were some of the biggest black acts of the time. Can you describe a little bit what the atmosphere was like at the concerts in which you shared the bill?
Well, both of these people were so popular at the time, having had all these big hit records, that there was that same feeling you feel today before the curtain opens, that great anticipation. They're going to see Bill Kenny and the Ink Spots. They're going to see Louis Jordan. And we were lucky enough to be the band. And, of course, that gave us a lot of help.
Did the audiences assume that you were black?
Of course. In those days, many of the places we played, had they suspected I was white, we would have been arrested.
Well, I remember when I interviewed Solomon Burke, he told a story about how when one of his records crossed over to the country charts, he started getting invitations to play certain places in the South with white crowds who would have never asked him to play if they knew he was black, and he showed up to one of these places, and it was quite a scene. Did anything similar ever happen to you?
No. We're talking now, I assume we're back in the 40s. If we are, it was much different than the Solomon Burke days of the 50s and or the 60s with Solomon Burke. You see, your life was on the line in those days. When our bus would cross the Mason-Dixon line and the driver would say, well, we just crossed the Mason-Dixon line, a pall would fall over the entire show. We'd all get quiet because we knew we were down there where we had problems. And many times we came close to being hurt. One time we stopped the bus to go to get some gas, and my little singer, little Esther, who was only 13, jumped off and went to the restroom. And I looked up, and there's a guy with a gun in my belly. And he's shaking, and he's all excited because the little black girl went to the white woman's bathroom. And I thought to myself, any death but this. But so she came out, and we went on down the road. But those things happened to us all the time. That was the open version of white racism as against the very subtle, pervasive, and institutionalized version that we have today.
Were in segregated places, were you treated as white or as black when you were traveling with black groups?
In black, as black. There's nothing so unique about a light black person. That's always been the case. And if I'm sitting on the black side having dinner, nobody questions it. He wouldn't be over there if he wasn't black. He ain't crazy, because it would kill him.
Did you do anything to look more black?
No.
Mm-hmm. Let me play one of the rhythm and blues records from the period that you made, and this was with the singer Little Esther, who we now know as Esther Phillips. And this was Double Crossing Blues. Do you want to say anything about this? You write
well,
the song?
Well, I can give you a little anecdote about it.
Yeah.
I was leaving my little chicken ranch in Watts back in the 40s, and with me were a group of guys I had found at the Barrel House, where I had a nightclub there called the Barrel House.
Mm-hmm.
And we were going to do their first record, and they became known as the Robins and later the Coasters. But Little Esther was a neighborhood little girl who used to help me with the other children catch my chickens when people would pick out the chicken they wanted. And then we would have refreshments later. And she ran up. She said, Johnny, let me go. So I said, oh, get in. So she got in. We went to Hollywood to the studio. And when we got there, we did the four sides by the Robins, and we had a few minutes left. So I asked the producer, Ralph Bass, I said, man, we got some time. Let me get these kids together. I got a song I think would make sense. He said, well, hurry up. You've only got a couple of minutes. So I taught it to him, and we did it. And it was called Double Crossing Blues. And I said, can I do it one more time? Because she kind of giggled. He said, no, that's it. But anyhow, that became the number one song of 1950, and it brought Little Esther to stardom, and it did an awful lot for us too. And by the way, the bass singer that you will hear on this record is the voice later who became Charlie Brown. How come everybody's always messing with the same guy
from the Coasters?
He was just a worker at my club, and I noticed he could sing and put him into this group, and he wound up singing on this big hit record with Esther Phillips.
Oh,
Bobby
that's great.
Nunn is his name.
And you're playing Vibes.
Yeah, and I'm playing Vibes.
Okay, here we go.
Been looking for you, Daddy. I just found you in time. You hit some other woman, and you swore that you were mine. What's the matter, Daddy? Don't my kisses satisfy? If I don't thrill you, baby, goodness knows goodness knows what I've tried.
You stayed out last night. Say you were playing cards. Can't understand it, baby. What makes your big fat head so hard? I'm gonna leave.
Johnny Otis is my guest. And by the way, he has a new album of some of his reissued recordings from the 1950s. It's called The Capitol Years. We'll be hearing some of that in just a little while. You discovered a lot of talent, not just a little Esther Phillips. What was your way of scouting for people?
Actually, my first singer was Ernestine Anderson when she was just a little girl.
Really?
And then came Esther Phillips. But after Esther Phillips' amazing success and became the big child star of the African-American community nationally, then everywhere we played, people, they would bring me their sons and their daughters backstage. I guess they figured I was an expert who knew how to make stars out of kids. And that's how it started. One day in Detroit, at the Paradise Theater, I asked the manager, I said, during this week that we'll be here, how about me doing a talent show to avoid having to have all these people coming around with their kids? He said, great. And we did. It was to have been 1 hour, but it stretched into 2 hours. And we found so many wonderful singers and players that day. I found Little Willie John, Jackie Wilson, and Hank Ballard and the Midnighters on that particular show. And there were probably others, but the record company I was scouting for, King, only wanted to deal with three at the moment. And I thought years later when Berry Gordy formed his great Motown story, I said, no wonder, look at the reservoir of talent here in Detroit.
It must have been funny, though, when the parents were bringing you their children. You must have been exposed to a lot of really untalented kids also.
Well, I learned quick. They would come and say, and they almost all had exactly, and I don't care if I was in Mississippi or Massachusetts, they would say, now, Mr. Otis, we know that you know, and if Junior has any real talent, you'll tell us the truth. And if he doesn't, of course, you'll. But they didn't mean that. I didn't know it. What they meant was, this is the world's answer to the great child star. This is it. And if I would dare to suggest they weren't, then I had an enemy on my hands. So I learned how to sidestep that and tell little fibs.
Let's take a short break, then we'll talk some more. My guest is rhythm and blues musician and band leader Johnny Otis. His hits have included Willie and the Hand Jive, and he launched the careers of singers such as Jackie Wilson, Etta James, and Big Mama Thornton. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Johnny Otis is my guest. We've been talking about rhythm and blues. When there was the transition between rhythm and blues and rock and roll, did you have to, did you find yourself changing the music, or were maybe the audiences changing that you were playing your music too?
Yeah, that's true. When I was dealing with the classic rhythm and blues that we developed back in the 40s, we did a lot of bluesy material because the black audience demanded it. As the transition occurred and as it developed, we then had to play more animated jump blues, boogie styles, and act, put on an act for white folks because they wanted it to be, well, they wanted to see us, you know, work and sweat, and that's what they liked. The early black audiences wanted a more musical, bluesy, jazz thing. The white audiences wanted that jump tune, boogie-woogie kind of thing. But what a strange thing has happened as the years went by. The roles reversed. Today, our audience for blues-oriented music is white, and the white and the black youngsters are not interested, and that's something that pains us terribly for many reasons, not just personally, but when we start to think from a cultural standpoint, how much we seem to have lost over the past 20 years or so in the African-American community where blues and jazz artistry is concerned.
Well, I want to play a song that you had that was a hit on the rock and roll charts in 1958, and this is Willie and the Hand Jive.
Let's play it, and then we'll talk about it.
Rockin' Billy. He can walk and stroll in Susie Q and do that crazy hand jive too. Papa told Willie, you'll ruin my home. You and that hand jive has got to go. Willie said, Papa, don't put me down. They're doing that hand jive all over town.
That's Hand Jive, which was a big hit for my guest, Johnny Otis, back in 1958. Tell me about writing the song.
My manager, the late Hal Zeiger and partner back at that time, we had a hit in 57 called Molly's Making Eyes at Me with the great Marie Adams singing, and it became a hit not here in the States, but in Europe, in England, it was number one. So he went over to set up the tour, and when he got back, he said, listen, I saw something interesting. I saw the young people around the London area in the venues where they couldn't dance, at the concerts and the theaters. As they sat there, they would do a thing that you guys in the big black bands used to do with their hands, you know, while the band was playing. And they call it Hand Jive. Why don't you write a song called Hand Jive, and maybe we'll do some good over in Europe. Well, I did, and luckily it became a hit everywhere.
So the Hand Jive was basically just kind of clapping and moving your hands.
Yeah, while you're sitting.
While you're sitting in a dance
version. But
it
became a whole dance later.
Well, you know, the Hand Jive is reissued on this new Capitol album, the Capitol Years. And inside, there's a little insert. Let me see if I can find it.
Yeah, and it's the thing that tells you how to do the Hand Jive dance. And it's all patterned out where you put your feet.
Exactly, yeah. It tells you, like, when to do the right-hand salute and the left-hand salute.
Yeah. I dare you to try to figure it out.
Oh, believe me, I was looking at it before. I thought it would be impossible.
Yeah.
I want to play something that you're featured on from this new reissue called The Capitol Years. And this is Can't You Hear Me Calling?
Okay.
And you're singing on this?
Yeah.
And what are you playing?
After a fashion.
Oh, you sound really good on it.
Oh, well, okay. You and my mother think so.
Okay, well, let's give it a listen.
Can't you hear me calling, baby, 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 please don't go.
Johnny Otis from the new album, The Capitol Years. You know, Ben Vaughan wrote the liner notes for this record, and in it he mentions that it was a publicity shot, that your goatee was airbrushed out so that you would look less ethnic. What was the story behind that?
Oh, Hal Zeiger, the late Hal Zeiger, God rest his soul, he was my partner at the time, and he did these things without even asking me. And while he wanted me to look less black, he wanted me to look less like a Greek, he wanted me to look like a nice Anglo-Saxon wasp, which is hard to do, but he tried.
So he airbrushed out the goatee?
Yeah. I don't think that sold any records.
Now, your family is Greek, was Greek?
Yeah.
Your parents?
Yeah.
And
yeah, we're and are. Yes.
And your last name was Veliotis?
Veliotis.
And when did you change it to Otis?
The kids at school kind of made that decision for me. They decided not to deal with try to remember how to pronounce that. They would say Johnny Otis, and that's the way it stuck.
So I know that your father had a grocery store. Was that in the same neighborhood that you lived in?
Oh, yes. The grocery store was downstairs, and we lived upstairs.
And this was in a black neighborhood?
Yes, in the heart of the black neighborhood.
So that, I guess, helps explain why you grew up with such black
identification. And that's also the luckiest thing that ever happened to me.
Uh-huh. So,
He might, in fact, have put it in a WASP neighborhood. Then what would have happened to me?
Did you not think of yourself as being white when you were growing up?
I didn't think about that at all. I had no concept about that. Luckily, my father was absolutely wonderful in that respect. And my playmates were, I didn't know it then, but they were black, African-American. I thought we were all the same thing. And I don't think it's so unique in America for white kids to grow up with black youngsters and come up together as brothers and sisters. What might be unique is not to veer away. I could not veer away because that's where I wanted to be. Those were my friends. That's where what I loved. It wasn't the music that brought me to the black community. It was the way of life. I felt I was black.
What was it about the way of life?
Everything about it. You know, different cultures have different characteristics. And the characteristics of the African-American community became my own. And I just wasn't willing to give that up to go become part of the mainstream community where people felt superior to black people and they oppressed black people and they practiced democracy and preached racism. I didn't want to be part of that. I want to stay in that sweet, beautiful black place in the black community.
Mm-hmm. So you're spending a lot of time now touring with your band.
Yes.
And you have a new record coming out.
I have two new records coming out.
Ah.
Did you get that record in the mail, the new
good,
one?
Good Lovin', yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, there's a young lady on that record named Ramona who I found recently. And she's in the tradition of Esther Phillips and Etta James and Linda Hopkins and Big Mama Thornton. In as much as I see that she has that indescribable something, she's a big lady, she's young, she's wonderful. And I know she's going to be a star given the correct opportunity.
Well, I wish you the best with the new records, and I thank you very much for talking with us. My guest has been Johnny Otis. He still tours with The Johnny Otis Show and hosts a radio program on KPFK in Los Angeles. Capitol Records has just released a collection of Otis's sessions from the 50s. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be winemaker Robert Mondavi. He's been a leading force in turning California's wines into world-class wines. I hope you can join us. Let's listen to a song from Johnny Otis's forthcoming album, Good Good Loving. This is Ramona singing In the Driver's Seat.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Jerry Orbach plays a man without a conscience in Woody Allen's new film Crimes and Misdemeanors. In the film Prince of the City, he played a cop on the take who refused to cooperate with an investigation into police corruption. Coming up, Orbach tells us how he got from Broadway musicals to movies. Also, rock historian Ed Ward re-examines Roy Orbison's early recordings for Sun Records. Ed says that early work shows Orbison to be more versatile than most people think. And there's a new book from Nigerian writer and Nobel laureate Wally Soyinka. It's called Isera, and it's an essay on the author's father. Book critic John Leonard has a review. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. According to the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador, at least one American was slightly injured when leftist rebels seized a hotel in San Salvador today. A journalist and the occupants of a Red Cross ambulance also were hurt. The State Department says at least 23 Americans were in the hotel when the pre-dawn raid occurred, but several were later escorted out of the building by government troops. With more on the story, Barry Schweid at the State Department.
The threats may be designed to coax the rebels into releasing their grip on the hotel, but by referring to the rebels as terrorists, the State Department could also be setting the stage for an assault by U.S. or more likely Salvadoran troops. Some Americans have come out from a portion of the hotel that the rebels had not occupied in their pre-dawn seizure. But even in the occupied section, it was not clear if all the American guests, and the count varies, are under rebel control. The rebels launched an offensive against the right-wing Christiani government 10 days ago, saying they wanted to force negotiations. But the Bush administration, which has supported the government with arms and other aid, says the aim is to decapitate that government. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schweid at the State Department.
Peace talks between the government of Nicaragua and the Contras have been suspended after the two sides were not able to agree on terms for a ceasefire. According to a spokesman, the talks broke down when the Contras refused a Sandinista demand that they agreed to a partial pullout of their forces to base camps in Honduras. Guilty pleas were entered in a Washington courtroom today by a key Iran-Contra figure and his corporation. Albert Hakim now faces up to 1 year in prison and a $100,000 fine. NPR's Nina Totenberg has more on the story.
Appearing before Judge Gerhard Gazelle, Albert Hakim admitted that he had illegally supplemented Oliver North's government salary by paying for North's security fence and then helping to conceal that payment. Also in court today was a lawyer for Lake Resources, the company that Hakim controlled, the main company through which Iranian arms sales profits were diverted to the Contras. On behalf of the corporation, lawyer John Hume pleaded guilty to one felony count of stealing government property by diverting the Iranian arms sales profits to the Contras. The maximum fine for the corporation is $500,000, but prosecutors said today that Judge Gazelle, at the time of sentencing, could order more money paid back to the federal government in the form of restitution from other accounts controlled by Hakim. Some $8 million are sitting in Swiss bank accounts set up by Hakim and other Iran-Contra defendants. Sentencing is set for February 1st. I'm Nina Totenberg at the Federal Courthouse in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 7 points to close at 2,639.29 on volume of some 147 million shares. Trading was moderate. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Sam Phillips and his Sun record label in Memphis became famous for producing a lot of great performers, including Elvis Presley and Jerry Lee Lewis. Today, rock and roll historian Ed Ward takes us through the late Roy Orbison's early years when he recorded for Sun.
Hey, baby, jump over here when you do the ooby-dooby. I done got it in there, ooby-dooby, ooby-dooby.
Until just the other day, I'd bought the standard rock and roll history line on Roy Orbison's early career. He started out at Sun Records, but his work there was a horrible mismatch of talent and material, which was why he didn't reach success until he went elsewhere. But recently, Rhino Records put out Orbison's complete Sun recordings, including lots of previously unreleased stuff, and I've changed my mind. Ooby Dooby was the song that brought him fame. It was first recorded for a tiny label in the same studios Buddy Holly had used for most of his good stuff. Sun Records chief Sam Phillips heard it and invited Roy and his band, the Teen Kings, to come to Memphis to record it. Released in May 1956, the song sold 300,000 copies, spent 2 months on the charts, and on its flip side, had a song that showed that Roy Orbison was a rocker who meant business.
you can't be my loving, baby. You ain't got the style. I'm gonna get some real gone love that'll drive a cool cat wild. Gonna move, roll and ride on down. Gonna get me a gal that'll go out on the town.
Now, the standard story says that Orbison wasn't comfortable being a Sun Records rocker, that he didn't enjoy the stuff Phillips was giving him to record. Well, it doesn't show on any of his subsequent singles. A real taste of what was ahead came out the next January. Easy to Love is the sort of record we're told Orbison didn't make at Sun, a country pop song with a touch of rock that sounded custom-made for the charts in 1957. The next single, though, was kind of perfunctory, although I sort of like it.
I'd like to be a hero, but I ain't got the nerve. I'm chicken-hearted.
Chicken Hearted was an odd choice for a single because it was mostly an instrumental with Roy singing the chorus. If anything, the reason Roy didn't do better at Sun is that Sam Phillips was losing interest with him and with the label. But Orbison was using the studio every chance he got, recording all kinds of stuff. He tried country.
Well, I've been traveling over mountains, now even through the valleys too. Well, I've been traveling night and day, running all the way, baby, trying to get to you. Well, since I read your loving letter, where you said you loved me true, well, I've been traveling night and day, running all the way, baby, trying to get to you.
He found a rhythm and blues song that fit his voice like a glove.
It's too late, she's gone. It's too late, my baby's gone. Wish I had told her she was my only one, but it's too late, she's gone.
And he was writing his own songs, like this one, about his first wife, which he gave to the Everly Brothers, who took it for a ride on the charts.
Well, well, hey, hey.
That recording is so informal, I bet it's a demo record, just intended to show how the song goes, and it may have been the very take he sent the Everlys. The more I listen to Roy Orbison's Sun recordings, the more I realize he had more than his West Texas origins in common with Buddy Holly. They both had a very delicate mixture of country, rhythm and blues, and rock and roll in their styles. Both sounded like their voices were too delicate for rock and roll, but somehow they made it work. There's no question but that Orbison's subsequent work at Monument Records, the big ballads with the big orchestras, were masterpieces. But I'm very grateful for the opportunity to hear how good what went before really was.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll. Orbison's records from 1956 to 65 are collected on an anthology called For the Lonely on Rhino Records. This is Fresh Air. In the new Woody Allen film, Crimes and Misdemeanors, Jerry Orbach plays the hoodlum brother of the ophthalmologist, played by Martin Landau. Orbach co-starred in the film Prince of the City and played Jennifer Grey's father in Dirty Dancing. For many years, he was best known for his roles in musicals on and off Broadway. I asked him first about Crimes and Misdemeanors. I told him I thought it was physically convincing to have him cast as Martin Landau's brother.
Well, I had never worked with Marty Landau before, but we both have similar backgrounds, and for some reason we really took to each other right away, and I guess we came off looking like brothers.
Did you think that you looked like brothers?
Yeah, sort of. I don't know what his specific background is, but I guess it's something close to mine.
Do you know if that came into play in the casting at all?
Actually, you know, Woody does a lot of reworking and reshooting. There was another actor who did those scenes originally, a fellow named Stephen Hill, who's a very good actor. And Woody looked at it, and I guess the relationship just didn't work between Mr. Hill and Mr. Landau, so he recast it with me.
How did he choose you, do you know? Did he audition you, or did he just call you up?
No, they just called and said, would you like to do this? I guess he'd seen me in other things.
Now, you're the brother without a conscience.
Right.
Did you feel you had to physically embody that? Do you know what I mean? That you really had to somehow physically and emotionally through your lines make the point that you were the brother without the conscience.
Oh, yes. This is the realist, the pragmatist, the one who lives in the real world, the one who's been involved with the garment business and restaurants in Atlantic City and knows people from all stratas of life. So there's a different kind of physicality about a guy like that than there is about a sort of self doubt, anguishing ophthalmologist.
But did you have any people in your life to model this character on?
Oh, yes. A lot of people that I've known over the years. Guys from the garment business, even guys from the arts, from the movie business. And it's not really a conglomeration or a compilation of different people. It's my observations that sort of sink into me. So it's a facet of me. You know, it's not really me, but it's somebody that I could be for a minute.
Now, the people who you're referring to in the garment business and in show business weren't actually killers, weren't people who knew people who can hire someone to do a hit.
Probably not, but I would guess that anybody involved in certain businesses like the garment business, trucking business, restaurant business, run into mob people and know them and know what they're capable of.
Woody Allen works with so much secrecy around the set. No one is allowed to know what the story is until the movie comes out. Does that put any strain on the actors?
Well, it can, I think. I only got my scenes. I never saw the whole script. But it didn't really matter that much to me. I understood at least my part of the story. So that didn't bother me. But it is kind of bordering on paranoia, but that's the way he works. You know, it's very secretive, and that's the way he wants it.
You co-starred in the film Prince of the City. I really consider that movie to be your movie. The movie, well, you play a corrupt cop who won't cooperate with a commission investigating members of a narcotic squad on the take.
Right.
Let me play a scene from it.
You indict me on a squawk of a dope dealer who tried to buy me out of a bust? You want to break up another federal operation that'll put away more quality mob guys in a year than you'll touch in your whole pissant career?
Detective Levy, you're hardly in a position.
I'll tell you what I'm in a position to do, and that's throw you out the window. It's only the fifth floor, but I try to aim you so you land on your pointed little head.
Levy, you can easily avoid trial. All you have to do is cooperate.
You got your mind made up to try me? Go ahead and try me. But not for a lousy $400. At least get me for assault.
Now, in this scene where you've just overturned the investigator's desk and then hit him real hard, it's very menacing.
Yes.
In that scene. Did you feel well-suited to that kind of menacing performance?
Oh, I love it because, you know, in real life, you can't go around throwing people's desks over and hitting them or kneeing them in the groin. You'll get sued. So to play that kind of a scene is a wonderful release for anybody because we have so many frustrations. There are people we'd like to hit, but we can't really do that. Also, it was a great release for the audience because in Prince of the City, the prosecutors are very dry and very nasty and, you know, they just don't give an inch to anybody. And it was sort of, the audience got its revenge on those guys for a minute there when I did that. It was a release for the audience.
There are a lot of expletives in your lines in Prince of the City. And I was wondering whether they were all said as written or whether you had the chance to kind of add them where they felt right.
No, they were pretty much written in stone. There was a very well-crafted script, and there wasn't much room for ad-libbing.
You actually got your start in musicals. As a matter of fact, why don't I play something here from 42nd Street?
I'm sorry, show business isn't for me. I'm going back to Allentown.
What was that word you just said? Allentown? I'm offering you a chance to star in the biggest musical Broadway scene in 20 years, and you say Allentown? Come on along and listen to the lullaby of Broadway. The hip hooray and ballyhoo. The lullaby of Broadway. The rumble of the subway train. The rattle of the taxi. The daffodils who entertain at Angelo's and Maxie's when a Broadway baby.
And I've read about you that your heroes when you were getting started were James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery Clift. They didn't do musicals with the exception of Brando's Guys and Dolls. Was it your ambition to do musicals when you were starting out?
It's funny. I always sang and loved singing, and I studied it. I came to New York after I got out of Northwestern. I was a very serious young actor. Did study with Lee Strasberg, Herbert Berghoff, Miro Rostova, worked at the Actors Studio. But the first job I got in New York was to replace the street singer in Threepenny Opera. And I actually then replaced McKeith, Mac the Knife, for about 6 months, worked with Lenya and everything. And I went from 3 years, 3.5 years in the Threepenny Opera to originate El Gallo in The Fantastics, which gave me a springboard to Broadway in a show called Carnival. And I just kept going from one show to another, from one musical to another, and it was a terrific life. My kids were being born, and I was raising a family in New York. And all my friends who couldn't sing, who were desperate and out of work, couldn't get a job off Broadway or anything, all went to Hollywood. And some of them became big stars out there. And that's sort of what I had wanted to do, you know, in the background. I'd always wanted to do that, work in film. And it just didn't seem to work out that way. I kept working, and it was all right.
So do you feel that Broadway might have actually slowed down your film career?
Oh, sure, but it was a good life. It still is. And I love jumping back from one thing to another.
It's interesting to me that you got your start in Threepenny Opera. It seems like the perfect place for you since it was a musical, but it was also a menacing musical. So,
yes, well, I had done the first American production of the Caucasian Chalk Circle at Northwestern, and I was very, very steeped in Brecht and pretty knowledgeable about Brecht's work and everything. So when I went to meet the director of Threepenny, and we chatted for a little while, and he gave me the job right away.
What kinds of roles did you think you were heading for when you were getting started? What did you think that your specialty was going to be?
I really didn't know I'd have any kind of a specialty. I thought I'd be a leading man, you know, and I was never a juvenile, even when I was 19 or 20. I mean, at 20, I was playing Mac the Knife opposite Lenya, which was outrageous. You know, I had no business being there. But I never looked like a kid. So it took me till I was into my mid-20s to start to really get the roles that I was, that I looked like. You know, I should have been 30, 35 playing them.
Did that seem like a hardship at the time, that you didn't look like a kid when you were a kid?
I don't know, not really. But sometimes I'd think, you know, the sort of Tab Hunter, Tony Curtis types, you know, I said, well, I can never compete with them, you know, back in the late 50s, because I was a little offbeat.
But of course, then their careers sometimes end early because...
Yes, I found that out.
Yeah.
Longevity is in being a character, man. Somebody said, are you ever going to retire? I said, no, I want to be like Melvin Douglas playing the grandpa on my deathbed when I'm about 85. That would be a pleasure.
Do you know what's next for you?
No, I don't. I never really do. I've got a bunch of movies that are in the can. I did one on The Last Exit to Brooklyn.
Oh.
I have... an interesting picture called Upworld, which has a little creature in it that I hope is going to be like an E.T. thing. Everybody's very high on it. And a couple of other things. And I just had the absolute thrill of working with Mike Nichols on a picture called Postcards from the Edge, Carrie Fisher's story, where I play Meryl Streep's father. And that was a kick.
Thanks.
Okay.
Well, for doing the interview.
It's a pleasure.
Jerry Orbach co-stars in the new film Crimes and Misdemeanors. This year, Polydor Records reissued a CD of the original 1961 Broadway cast recording of Carnival. And here's Jerry Orbach singing Her Face.
Everywhere I look, I can see her face. I can see her face, see it everywhere. And when I close my eyes, it stays. And like a leaf whirls on a wind, around my mind it plays.
This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda, what stories do you have coming out of El Salvador?
Terry, we hope by the time we go on the air to be able to say with some authority what we think is happening down there. Rebel forces in San Salvador have taken over a luxury hotel. There are some Americans in the hotel. The head of the Organization of American States is there. And we're in search of some people from the FMLN to tell us what their objective was and what they think they're trying to do. We're also covering the Congress on its way home for Thanksgiving, and we have some Thanksgiving stories, a turkey drop and a turkey dinner.
Thanks, Linda. That and more is coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. In 1982, the Nigerian playwright, critic, and novelist Wally Soyinka published Ake, The Years of Childhood, about growing up in western Nigeria. Soyinka's second memoir, Isera, evokes the Nigeria of Soyinka's father. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
I'm quoted on the jacket of Isera. Back in 1982, before Wally Soyinka won his Nobel Prize, reviewing Ake, The Years of Childhood, I asked, what if V.S. Naipaul were a happy man? What if V.S. Pritchett had loved his parents? What if Vladimir Nabokov had grown up in western Nigeria and decided that politics were not unworthy of him? Obviously, I liked Ake a lot. Isera isn't as wonderful. This is not because of craft, it's a cunning book, but because of family feeling. Sons feel differently and write differently about their fathers than they do about their mothers. About Soyinka's father, the headmaster of a grammar school, all we learned in Ake was that he was a man of wicked patience. About his mother, called the Fighting Christian, who ran a shop, professed nonviolence, and beat him with a stick, we learned much more. The boy grew up in a garden of cultures, British colonialism and Yoruba folk myth, the Bible and the hex, radio days that began and ended by asking God to save the wrong king, nightmares of demonic possession, songmasters, sewing academies, goats, pomegranates, snakes, divination birds, and roasted egg of praying mantis. And everything that happened to him seemed a preparation for his role as his mother's agent. When the women of Ake rose in magnificent rebellion against the English tax collector, This boy, who would grow up to be a novelist, playwright, critic, and professor of comparative literature, was their courier from mothers to sons, from black to white, from culture to culture. Isera is about the father, less passionate and perhaps less lovable. Instead of writing from the point of view of a precocious child who forgets nothing, who will locate the lost child in all of us, anterior to language, inside sound and smell, wide-eyed, brave, and flummoxed, Sayanka this time keeps a respectful distance. In 1984, he opened a tin box of his father's letters and journals. From these, changing names and imagining conversations, he reconstructs the colonial Nigeria of 50 years ago, the coming to consciousness and then to action of an indigenous intelligentsia. These African schoolmates from the same training seminary have become teachers, pharmacists, union organizers, and capitalist entrepreneurs. They want to name a new king in their region of Western Nigeria, and somewhat to their surprise, they find they have the clout to do so, not to mention a white horse for the would-be king to ride. They have discovered politics. Among these kingmakers, Sayanka's father, with his points of caution, his ironic detachment, and his secret consulting of Yoruba oracles, is a reluctant semi-hero, a kind of clerk of the collective will. On the day of decision, not by accident, Sayanka's father for the first time meets a white American pen pal with whom he's been corresponding sight unseen for years. I won't spoil the shock of recognition. I will say I'm sorry that the fighting Christian is sick, hospitalized, and unremarked during these events, and that her son, of whom it was said in Ake that he will kill you with questions, is also missing in action. Whereas Ake was magical, Isera is dutiful. But dutiful from a writer of this quality is nevertheless required reading.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Isera, a Voyage Around essay by Wally Sayanka. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shorrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Robert Mondavi, one of the winemakers who brought a new respectability to California wine. And rock critic Dave Marsh plays some of his selections for the 1001 best singles ever recorded. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.